Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you. Yeah, she's gonna get you. Mother Nature, she's grown to hate you. She's gonna get you. Gonna get you, you betcha. Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. It's NBL on PRN.FM. This January 5th, 2016 edition, episode 71, and our first episode of 2016 of Nature Bats Last comes to you live from the Mud Hut in southern New Mexico with our live studio audience of two.
Oh, yay!
Pipe down, studio audience. Our thanks to Afrozin for his theme song contribution. You can find more of his work on SoundCloud.com. Recently, we've discovered we made the most popular list in the science and medical category on Podbean, which archives our show along with thousands of others. So, yay NBL, and thank you so much, listeners, for tuning in and driving our numbers. So we're popular, guy.
Hard to imagine with our message.
We begin today's show with an explanation of what we are trying to accomplish with this and upcoming episodes. We'll use this format about once each month. We started last month with an episode focused on Michael Mann and his work. We complain about mainstream media being bought by special interest groups like those who run the fossil fuel industry, for example. We rarely complain when our experts are tied to an institution, organization, business, or even a paycheck. The fact that someone is giving them a paycheck should be a red flag. Not everyone gets a paycheck. I don't. Guy doesn't. In fact, none of our major contributors to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network receive a paycheck. We are not on the payroll at PRN, nor have any, or have they asked us to edit any of our, or censor any of our content. There are no sponsors on PRN. We are not governed by the FCC, and we can say whatever the fuck we want when we want. Today, we continue our series of episodes focused on leading scientists and public figures who have major voices. They are vital to the flow of information heard by most people. The general citizenry receives information from leading climate scientists and activists who work for different institutions and organizations. We are not saying they have all been bought. We are saying they are censored, whether it be by the institution or organization they work for, or self-censorship in response to potential action taken against them. They are paid. We are not. With this episode and others in the future, we will highly encourage anyone who receives significant airtime on major media outlets to become free agents. This isn't to say you can't have a job or make an income. We are, however, saying that if you are a leading voice in environmental justice, social justice, or climate science, your voice and your word are suspect. In order to become a trusted member of information exchange, a sacrifice is required. Actually, it only feels like a sacrifice until you've taken the steps we have taken. Leaving the institution or organization that pays you will set you free and give the public a reliable voice. We here at NBL are not well-known or leading voices in the mainstream media, yet we have taken steps to be considered reliable voices.
And we made the list for the Podbean.
Right.
So.
And we're popular.
We're moving up.
Mm-hmm. Next thing you know, Yokin won't be able to trust us. Please join us in supporting those who must take such a step. The echo chamber must become quiet. This week, we're pointing out the discrepancies between Dr. Catherine Hayhoe's public statements and reality. It's a call-in show, and it's also a call-out show. So please give us a toll-free call at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888. As we call out Dr. Hayhoe for her inconsistencies. Guy?
Catherine Ann Scott Hayhoe is an atmospheric scientist and associate professor of political science at Texas Tech University, where she is also director of the Climate Science Center. She has worked at Texas Tech since 2005. She's Canadian. She has authored more than 60 peer-reviewed publications, and along with her husband, Andrew Farley, she wrote a book titled A Climate for Change, Global Warming Facts for Faith-Based Decisions. John Abraham, professor of thermal and fluid sciences at the University of St. Thomas School of Engineering in Minnesota, has called Hayhoe, quote, perhaps the best communicator on climate change, end quote. Time magazine listed her among the 100 most influential people in 2014. Also in 2014, the American Geophysical Union awarded her its Climate Communications Award. Hayhoe received a degree in physics and astronomy from the University of Toronto and her master's and PhD in atmospheric science from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. She is the daughter of missionaries and is an evangelical Christian. In the wake of COP21 in Paris, we pointed out that Hayhoe said, and I quote, as a climate scientist, this is like the best Merry Christmas, Happy Hanukkah, and your NSF grant was funded without revisions, all rolled into one big package with fancy French wrapping ever.
Wow.
Ta-da! Happy days are here again. Hayhoe's description of the disaster in Paris contrasts sharply with descriptions of other notable people. Climate scientist James Hansen called COP21 a fraud and bullshit. Mr. Optimist himself, Bill McKibben, correctly concluded the agreement reached in Paris will leave us with a planet that is, quote, uninhabitable. But Hayhoe thinks COP21 was a big win for humans and planet Earth, not to mention humans on planet Earth. Hayhoe gained fame when she was featured in the initial episode of James Cameron's The Years of Living Dangerously. She is notably married to an evangelical preacher, notable primarily because she points out that climate science and Christianity are not mutually exclusive. But at least in the case of Dr. Hayhoe's understanding of COP21 and its outcome, reason and climate science are mutually exclusive. Homo sapiens sapiens, the self-proclaimed, doubly proclaimed wise ape, will need a lot more help to survive about climate change than can be provided by Santa Claus, the Easter Bunny, and the invisible man in the sky. Hayhoe's magical thinking might as well invoke unicorns and pixie dust as solutions to the myriad predicaments we face. I wrote Dr. Hayhoe to tell her we'd be doing a show focused on her malpractice. Shortly thereafter, she unfriended me on Facebook.
That's a pretty amazing.
This is serious stuff.
Serious. Whoa.
We're not talking about the New York Times. We're talking about something with far greater reach.
So Facebook. You're saying there's friends on your – there's room on your friends list now.
Yes, exactly. I have one more slot.
Right. Oh, just filled.
It seems the reality of my message is just a bit too dire for Dr. Hayhoe. Bear in mind that I don't have a position on abrupt climate change. There's no position on abrupt climate change any more than there's a position on the temperature at which water boils. We're hoping Dr. Hayhoe will call into today's show, as we asked her to do. But we certainly don't expect to hear from her. If she can't interact on social media, it's difficult to imagine her talking to us in real life. Or even on the radio. Let's start with audio from a YouTube clip. This clip was posted by the Citizens Climate Lobby on August 17th, 2015, and it is titled Dr. Catherine Hayhoe Interview. So let's have a few seconds of that clip.
And so, you know, you talked about, some of us have a problem trying to square that circle, so to speak, sometimes, because we want to approach it from a, like you said, shared values of faith and being good stewards of the earth, but there's also the values that some people hold that say, you know, it's a big government solution, therefore it's against those values that I believe in. So any tips or thoughts on how we, you know, sort of square that or align that a little more?
Man, that's the toughest one, because I actually really believe that in 99% of the cases, people who disagree with the science of climate change are really doing so because they disagree with the solutions.
Right. Yeah.
So it's really important, I think, to recognize that climate change is a big problem and that there are solutions that actually some people might agree with who don't like, you know, a big government role in our personal lives. So, for example, renewing renewable energy investment has a huge impact on the local economy. It makes us more energy independent. The military is investing extremely heavily in renewable energy because they know that's the way of the future. It reduces air pollution. Anybody whose kid has asthma cares about air pollution.
Yeah.
Saving energy is just a conservative thing to do. I mean, why should we be wasteful with our energy? If we're conservative, we should conserve the energy. So I think it is important to show that there are solutions that are compatible with a whole range of values. It isn't just a, you know, big government comes in, tells people what to do. There's a lot that we individually can support that is good for ourselves, it's good for our families, it's good for our health, and it's even good for the economy.
Yeah.
Okay. Couple things, bullet points that came up that I wrote down as she was speaking. Good stewards of the earth, which kind of puts a human-centric, obviously, lens on where she's coming from, which kind of explains the rest of what she's about to say. Solutions for climate change, because we live in a culture where there are no predicaments, even though there's a word, predicament. And then investment, and military is investing. Doesn't matter that the military, in particular our military, is one of the biggest, worst emitters of carbon that there is. So
right. Well, and I think she's playing to her audience here.
Right.
Her audience is self-proclaimed conservatives.
Oh, yeah. She's good at what she does.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
They're not conservative, by the way.
Yeah.
They're neoconservatives. Edward Abbey pointed out 40 years ago, neocons are not new, and they're not conservative.
Yeah.
So she claims to be pitching to a conservative audience by playing the military theme.
Yeah, and conserving energy.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, we can talk all day about civilization as a heat engine,
yeah,
supported now by abundant refereed journal literature with which he's clearly unfamiliar. We can talk, as you mentioned, about civilization and maintaining civilization as a predicament. The climate change, in addressing it,
mm-hmm,
represents a predicament, not a problem. And the journal literature indicates that we can only solve this predicament through the collapse of industrial civilization.
Right. I don't know. I guess I'm confused because every time we talk about these folks, 99.9% of them, they never mention the C word, civilization.
Right. Well, no, that's like mentioning taking a shit in public.
Which I have not done.
We don't have that conversation. We don't talk about bodily functions. We don't talk about sex. We don't talk about death.
Okay, stop talking about that.
Oh, right. We're most popular now.
Yeah, we're getting bleeped.
So we'll talk more about those issues, predicaments, and the things that the words we cannot say in this culture. They'll come up again with some of her other clips. Again, you can call in. The toll-free number is 888-874-4888.
I think the other thing that is interesting is when people, they mention solutions first, and they do it because so people can understand it, I get it, but they lump climate change as the problem. And they never point out actually the things that need, quote-unquote, to be solved. Like, if they started going into detail what's happening, well, quickly they would find out that these things have no solutions.
Well, not only that, but that climate change is a symptom.
Right.
It's not something we can address directly.
Right.
It's just symptomatic of far more vexing issues.
Well, and that's the part of the problem with this culture. It's the same thing with the war on terror. You know, it used to be when we went to war, well, there was the enemy.
Right.
They're over there, and we're going to go get them. But now it's this concept. And much like climate change, we can't touch it necessarily. We can't see it, you know. And so it's this thing, it's this unknown, which, you know, if we raise enough war bonds, we can solve.
Right, right. And that brings to mind a story. Can I tell a story?
Sure, yeah. Once upon a time.
Once upon a time, I was teaching a class called Conservation Biology at the University of Arizona. And this was the fall of 2001.
Mm-hmm. Well, then.
Yeah. That's a long time ago, yeah. Isn't it? But something happened then in the fall of 2001 that some people proclaimed was the Pearl Harbor of our day.
Technically, it was the summer of 2001.
That's right. It was September 11th. It was 10 days away from fall.
I always think of fall as being September as well, so I forget it. Go on.
Well, you know, and some meteorologists say fall begins the first day of the year that the meteorological fall begins.
Right.
So, anyway.
Anyway, sorry. I digress.
So there was a woman in my class, in this conservation biology class, called Tara. So I could hardly let a class period go by without pointing out that the war on Tara has so far had no effect on Tara in this. Oh, look, she's still here. You call this a war? I don't think she appreciated it.
She dropped out shortly.
There were a lot of people who didn't appreciate me in my class. It's weird.
Which is why you find yourself with me.
But hey, I'm not living in a tent, and we're popular.
Right, right.
So neener, neener.
Neener.
The next clip, like all the ones we'll play today, comes from YouTube. This one was posted on July 17th, 2015, and it's titled Catherine Hayhoe Interview on Christian Broadcast Network Raises a Ruckus. Correct. We're going to play 40 seconds from that clip.
Our atmosphere. The Earth heats up, and the Earth gives off heat energy. And it turns out these little gases that are transparent to the sun's energy trap the Earth's heat very effectively. Our planet is 30 degrees Celsius warmer than it would be without this blanket. Without this blanket, our planet would be a frozen ball of ice, and we wouldn't be sitting here today. If this is natural, what's the problem? The problem is that we have been adding to this blanket. This blanket is the perfect temperature for life. But we have.
So, yes, that's a fairly simplistic description of what goes on with greenhouse gases. They're actually trapping the heat. Mm-hmm. The solar radiation comes in, and much of the long wave radiation is trapped. It can't escape. So, it's like putting a bunch of blankets on the bed. In that case, you, the human animal, is providing the heat.
Right.
In this case, the heat is coming from the exterior source, from our sun, and the blankets are trapping it. And we add more blankets, like rolling up the windows on the car. But her proposed solutions to this predicament are the light bulbs and conservation arguments from decades past.
Right. But that's, like you mentioned earlier, that's what her audience will, one, accept, two, understand, and three, it's put in terms of, again, these things, this is a problem that can be solved, because she drops the P word there again. And, you know, that's not anything new. Everybody is dropping the word problem. But
right, and this is completely consistent with the trap we found ourselves in, mm-hmm. in the educational arena, isn't it? I mean, we identify things as problems, and then we point out how we can solve them. And it's only by identifying them as problems that we're going to come up with solutions.
Yeah, and then what we end up doing is adding more and more blankets and issues and feedback loops that we think we can overcome.
Right, and there's never any mention of the underlying predicament.
No, because, again, that doesn't exist. At least it's not a possibility because it comes back to, again, we don't believe in death, ultimately.
Right.
I mean, we do for everyone else.
For other people.
For other people and for other cultures.
For other
species,
animals.
Right. Yeah.
But not this civilization.
No.
Not me.
Certainly not
this
me.
Culture. And, well, of course not you. I mean, you got the Jesus look going.
Right. And not our audience. Although,
so again, the light bulbs and conservation arguments from decades of the past indicate that Hayhoe is unfamiliar with Jevons' paradox, despite the book authored by William Stanley Jevons and published in, wait for it, 1865.
Well, I mean, maybe she's got a big reading list, just haven't got it.
Yeah. Okay. The book is called The Coal Question.
The idea is that conservation won't work and efficiency will cause finite materials to be used even faster than otherwise were later recognized by economists and relabeled the Kazum-Brooks postulate. But the same idea has been around for more than 140 years.
So when you're in school to become a climate scientist, and again, that's another discussion we can have about what actually makes a climate scientist and what doesn't and who's categorizes that. Do these things just not come up?
Well, you know as well as I do that the very word that starts with C and has way too many syllables for most Americans to handle doesn't come up.
Yeah, but
it's unquestionably good. We don't even say the word.
I get it. But maybe they don't even have to mention the word. Let's forget the word and they can call it something else. Because sometimes when we mention that particular word, they use the other C word, which they replace it with, which is capitalism.
Mm-hmm, right.
So I'm wondering if even – and maybe it does because from time to time I hear climate scientists mention about unregulated capitalism and things like that.
Right.
But they – I don't know. Do they think that somehow if they just replace it with socialism or they replace it with some sort of utopian version of capitalism that – somehow we'll get through this.
Well, some people clearly believe that, or at least they say they believe that. I mean, Naomi Klein comes immediately to mind,
right?
Selling her $40 book and being opposed to capitalism.
Right. My book will only be $39.99.
There you go. See, you are the anti-capitalism guy.
But I have to imagine when folks go to conferences, when they're in school learning about these things, when they're talking to their peers.
You know, I was at a conference probably
they all agree?
15 years ago. No, it just goes without question. They don't even have to agree. They don't bring it to a vote. Nobody votes on civilization. Mm-hmm. We don't even talk about it. We just go with it because it's all we know. Yeah. I was at a conference probably 15 years ago in this very state in New Mexico, and I was giving the talk right before lunch. And everybody ran over time, and the moderator sucks. It's just like every other conference I've been to, where the moderator doesn't cut people off. So pretty soon it was becoming clear to me that I wasn't going to have 40 minutes for my presentation.
Right.
And then by the time I got up there, I had 15.
So you just put a slide up, civilization with a circle around the line. Comments?
And it was one of those cases where I got to the very rudiments mm-hmm. of how we live.
Yeah.
And this was a long time ago, and the guy who rode with me in the car from Tucson to Albuquerque, I was sharing a motel room with him too, and right after the talk he says, you know, you're talking about terminating civilization.
Oh.
Because it sunk in. He got it.
Right.
He, unlike almost everybody else in the room,
right.
He actually got it. You know, I'll say it right out loud.
Yeah.
But people don't hear it, and that happens with you too.
I'm wondering if it's the same thing, though, with capitalism, because when you, in this country at least, when people used to question capitalism, you were labeled unpatriotic. You were labeled a communist.
Right.
A socialist. In some cases, you still are by particular parts of, obviously, the political spectrum. But I'm wondering if that's maybe the path, not that there's enough time for this path, we're all on our own path. People now are questioning capitalism all the time. People are writing books about it.
Right.
People have written books, obviously, about civilization and questioning that, which nobody apparently has read. But I'm wondering if that particular line of thought will eventually lead to civilization like it did to capitalism, where we're going. It makes mainstream media. It makes people who are talking heads becoming, you know, the Naomi Kleins of the world are on the air talking about capitalism. The Chris Hedges.
Right. And so at some point, maybe we'll even get deeper at the root. Is that what you're suggesting?
Yeah, maybe.
And then it won't be about an ism anymore.
I'm asking what you think. Do you think that's going to happen?
No, I think we're all dead before that happens.
Okay. Well, that's all I need to know. Well, it's a great show, folks.
We do have a caller, Shalel from Long Island.
Long Island.
Are you still with us, Shalel?
I am here. Hi, Guy. Hi, Mike.
Hi.
How you guys
What's
doing?
Up?
Thanks so much for telling us the truth. God, You know, I mean, I feel so much like a mushroom, you know, sometimes, but when I listen to you guys, you know, I just get that resonance of truth, and it's so refreshing because there's so few places to get that.
So you're saying the old adage is true. You can fool some of the people some of the time.
That's true.
Never mind.
I know you're fond of saying that we're 20 years too late to save the habitat of 9 million species here on Earth. I beg to differ with that. I think we're 72 or 3 years too late because of the military nuclear energy programs of certain countries creating over 300,000 tons of irradiated fuel rods sitting at a nuclear plant near you, reliant on grid power to keep them from igniting in unquenchable radiotoxic fire. With CO2 and methane going exponential, the climate wilding and the sea levels rising. Oh, and the death plants are located on the coastlines and seem to be sited mostly on earthquake faults. What could possibly go wrong?
Man, you're a bummer.
I'm a bummer to you. That made my day. Wow.
There's a bumper sticker.
I didn't mean to bring you down. But, you know, I mean, it's you know, 20 years before I was born, you know,
well, right.
they pretty much sealed our fate with this stuff.
Yeah, you bring up a good point. People ask me this all the time when I'm doing presentations.
Yeah.
They ask me, when did we cross the Rubicon? When was it too late? And I don't really know whether it was when we started controlling fire, when we came out of the trees, at the advent of the nuclear age, which I think was in 1939, was it the advent of civilization several thousand years ago, 6,000 to 10,000 years ago? Was it at the beginning of abrupt climate change? It seems to me that the human species has come to a fork in the road a few million times, and every time so far we've taken the wrong turn.
So how are we still here? That's why I wake up every day, and I'm like, well, you know, I could look at this as a miracle, because we're still here, you know? And I've been doing that since I'm 8, guy. Since I'm 8. I had, you know, they used to make the whoop-whoop noise, and we had to get under our desks because the nukes were coming, and I'm like, well, what's the desk going to do, you know?
So well, they were like oak. That's a hard way.
The principal's office, but... you know, I had a plan. I live on Long Island, so, you know, if I knew the nukes were incoming, this is at 8, I had planned to go to the old World's Fair Tower and get a good view for about a millisecond before I was vaporized. And I've been living with this since I'm 8. And, you know, the waiting is the hardest part, as the Tom Petty song goes. And I'm not afraid of death. You know, I kind of mourn for life on the planet, of course, but, you know, I mean, I don't know. I mean, I can just, I don't know. I can only recommend that you go do an ayahuasca ceremony or something and know that you know, your spiritual self, of course, lives on.
Well, yeah. I mean, people have suggested all kinds of mind-altering chemicals for me. But I'm pretty sure that's personal. I don't think it has anything to do with discovering the truth. I don't know.
No, it's just you.
Well, know that you are very well loved, and I really appreciate what you guys are doing, and I wish you blessings.
Thank you. Thanks for calling in, Shalal. I appreciate it. You're listening to Nature Bats Last on the Progressive Radio Network. On this episode and several future episodes of Nature Bats Last, we're going to call out some well-known climate scientists for the disparity between what they say and write and the reality of abrupt climate change. The next clip, our third clip for this show, is from December 4th, 2015, during the early days of COP21. On YouTube, it's titled A Climate for Change, Conservation and Faith with Dr. Catherine Hayhoe. So let's go ahead and have about 30 seconds of that clip.
Or in Salt Lake City. what do we have in common? We already have all the values we need to care about climate change in our hearts. If we are a human living on this planet, it just makes sense that we want a safe, secure planet with access to food, water, a healthy economy, job opportunities. If we're a Christian, we have even more. How do we connect the dots between the science of climate change and our Christian faith? If we look in the Bible at the very...
Do you want to go first?
Sure. Well, obviously, her Christian faith is a product of civilization itself.
Yes.
And then my favorite is job opportunities.
Absolutely.
You know, it doesn't... At this level, if you're somebody that has the education that she has, and you're smart enough to know your audience, and which she does, and I know she's not going to say this publicly, but privately, she cannot connect the idea of job opportunities in a growing economy with what's actually providing, I guess, her income. And maybe she can, and maybe she's just, you know, she's just very sly. I don't
know. Just along for the ride?
Yeah. You know, maybe those are her values.
I suspect those are her values. Right. Apparently, Hayhoe is unfamiliar with the Referee Journal literature and pointing out that only collapse of civilization prevents runaway climate change. Apparently, she is unaware, or perhaps unconcerned, and that would be my guess, that the industrial economy is driving to extinction 150 to 200 species every day. She presents the classic win-win approach in which we can grow the economy and also solve climate change, reminiscent of Michael Mann's statements. Hayhoe is spouting nonsense contrary to evidence.
Yeah, and this comes back to, you know, particular institutions and organizations that you're affiliated with on some level, because you're not necessarily, well, one, you're not going to get any sort of public recognition, and two, you're not going to get any sort of support, and three, you're going to, your popularity will go beyond Podbean if you say things that, like you mentioned, the win-win, and that's an American thing for sure, although I think it's become obviously a global mantra.
Of course, I love the little clip from Louis C.K. about it, about jobs.
Mm-hmm.
Do you remember, can you channel Louis C.K. for us a little bit?
Yeah, no.
You know,
I know who he is.
I mean, the guy is on Earth, And God is talking to him.
Mm-hmm.
And God says, why are the polar bears all brown? Did you shit on the polar bears? And the guy says, that's oil.
Right.
Well, what do you need oil for? What do you need? Why would you possibly need oil? I gave you everything. All the food is lying on the ground. Just pick it up off the floor. I just left it right there for you. What do you need? And the guy says, well, jobs.
Jobs? Jobs? What do you need a job for?
That's right. What do you need a job for? I gave you everything. What is a job? God actually asked him, what is a job? And he says, well, it's like you're at this call center and he answers the phone, somebody wants to know why their game doesn't work. I gave you everything.
You gotta go faster.
Right. And that's sort of the bottom line of that episode. Is the conclusion that we must go faster.
Right. You know, I had a talk with a former colleague of mine who a few years ago was looking. She became disenfranchised but continued to want to fight the good fight in education. And her solution was to open up a school in which she could have a platform that she could live with, so to speak. But... I asked her what really was the purpose of this school, and she says, well, you know, we need kids to go out there and be qualified and be motivated and seek careers that inspire them. I said, listen, we don't need people who want careers. We don't need people seeking and pursuing jobs and careers. I understand we have to eat. I get the reality of that. But we don't need that.
Right.
That's not what school is for. School is not to produce people to go get jobs.
Right.
It's so that they question what's going on, and hopefully they go, this school's fucked up.
You would think they would reach that conclusion no matter what school they're at.
Right.
Because it's all promotion of the dominant paradigm.
Yeah. But it all goes, like you said earlier, it's everything that matters is unsaid.
Yeah. We just can't even have the conversation.
And what doesn't matter gets talked about at length.
Finally, we'll play a YouTube clip posted by Trinity Western University on October 21st, 2014. Slightly less than 15 months old, it's the oldest clip we're going to play today, and we're going to play almost 5 minutes from it. It's titled, Dr. Catherine Hayhoe, Climate Change, Facts, Fictions, and Our Faith.
So what I want to talk about tonight, my central premise, so to speak, is this. Faith and science are completely different. But they're complementary and they are essential to understanding and responding to the challenges that we face today. I don't think that we can do that without one and the other working together. And I really believe that climate change is one of the most urgent challenges we face today, as well as a challenge that we need both our science and our faith to tackle. What do I mean by this? What do I mean by the fact that they're so different? Well, one of the most frequent questions that I get is, do you believe in global warming? Or it's often phrased more along the lines of, so you believe in global warming? My answer to that is no. I don't believe in global warming. And that usually shocks people enough that they're willing to listen to what I have to say next. What I want to do is I want to give us a couple of definitions to start off with. If you use Google, I highly recommend it, you will get this definition. Faith is defined as a strong belief that is based on spiritual apprehension rather than proof. What is science? Science is defined as the systematic study of the physical and natural world through observation and experiment, in other words, proof. A better definition, I think, comes from the book of Hebrews, where faith is defined as the evidence of things not seen. If I could go back in time and sit there beside the author of Hebrews and nudge his arm as he was writing, I would suggest that he add this to the verse, that science is the substance of reality here and now, not things hoped for in the future, and it is the evidence of things we do see. So that is why I do not believe in global warming. I believe in God. I look at the evidence around us to determine whether climate is changing, whether humans are involved in that, and what it is that we might be able to do about it. But the science can only take us so far. Science is not complete in and of itself. Science is a tool that we use to understand the world around us. So, for example, in the area of climate change, science can answer questions for us, like, is climate changing? Science can then answer questions like, why is climate changing? Is this microphone off? I'm getting some bad feedback here. Am I supposed to?
Insert your own joke here. Audience.
There we go. I think I, no? No, it's not off. There we go. That's the way to turn it off. Yes, there's nothing like technology. So, as I was saying, science can tell you how to unplug things. Science can tell you whether climate is changing. Science can tell you why it's changing. And science can even tell us, if we do X, here are the likely results. If we do Y, here are the other results. But that is where science ends. Because it is rare that we encounter a decision in our lives that is black and white. Now, this may happen once in a while, and if you have such a decision in front of you, congratulations. Treasure it. Remember it. Because in our lives, we're constantly making decisions where there are many shades of gray. There are pluses and minuses to everything we do. That is where our faith comes in. For many of us, our values come from our faith, and our values determine the choices that we make, the decisions that we make, and the outcomes that result. So with the situation of climate change, our decision of whether to acknowledge whether it's real or not, whether to take action on it or not, if we do take action, what to do about it, those are not scientific decisions. Those are value-based decisions. And that is where our faith comes in.
That is where we have to look to what is in our heart, not what is in our head, to figure out what we think is the right thing to do. And what we think is the right thing to do might be completely different than someone else because we have different values. But our values are central to who we are. It's part of our identity. It's what makes us us. And that's why it is so important, I believe, not to have a schizophrenic perspective on the world, but to see ourselves as whole people who integrate our facts with our faith.
I think she'd like to go back to the time of the author of Hebrew. I would argue that with respect to science, she's already there. This presentation, like most of Hayhoe's, is aimed at the typical Google-using fifth grader. She mixes faith and science and claims we need both to address climate change. Proclaiming her belief in God gains her an enormous audience in a country dominated by believers. Among the world's industrialized countries, the United States stands alone in its capitulation to superstition. The citizenry of the United States is dominated by a belief in that which cannot be seen. The belief is so strong, the cultural narrative so powerful, that the issue cannot be discussed in this country any more than we can talk about death or sex in adult conversation. Hayhoe does not understand science and its potential role in our lives. My values do not come from faith because I have none in the sense Hayhoe is claiming. I use reason to guide my decision-making. As Edward O. Wilson pointed out in his 1998 book, Consilience, we can use scientific rationalism to guide our lives. We need not rely on superstition, as Hayhoe claims. And don't even get me started on Hayhoe's lack of understanding about philosophy. I understand that not everybody with a doctor of philosophy degree has a clue about philosophy, but to claim such knowledge while clearly exhibiting otherwise is maddening, at least to this PhD-possessing armchair philosopher.
Has she ever thought maybe for a second that our values are what put us here? In this spot?
Good question.
And yet we continue to follow our values. You know, where did our values come from? Where, you know, obviously the narrative they came from put us in a predicament that we're currently in. And so we're going to just to rely on those to get us, quote unquote, out of it.
It's working great so far for a few people.
For a few people.
And most notably, it's working for white people in the global north.
Right.
People who look a lot like you and me and Catherine Hayhoe.
Right. She also talks about decision to take action, like it's an individual decision that you can somehow make about climate change and take action.
Right, and there's that light bulbs and, right. and Prius argument again.
Right. Because
I mean, and don't get me wrong, I have those squirrely light bulbs and a Prius.
Yeah.
So I solved it.
It gives people a sense that they are in control of what's happening when they've never been in control of what's happening.
Right. I mean, there's a reason she makes the 100 most influential people in Time magazine. Because she promotes this culture, the dominant narrative, mm-hmm. while claiming, completely without evidence, that our individual actions are the very heart of what's going to solve the issue.
Right. Yeah, she loves what we are, and she can take us to a better place. Boy, this sounds familiar.
I stopped going to that church when I was 12.
Well, any more thoughts on Catherine before we move on to climate update?
I think I have many thoughts about her. I mean, it's just astonishing to me that we are still stuck in this paradigm and that the mainstream media continues to promulgate fixes to a predicament, mm-hmm. and the fixes are rooted in the very predicament.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a self-reinforcing feedback loop.
Right.
We're going to use civilization to overcome a predicament created by civilization?
Right.
Come on.
Right.
And I guess what surprises me even more is that the people keep falling for it.
Yeah.
You know, the vast majority of people are being told what they want to hear. So what's not to like?
Well, and I think the thing that's sort of ironic, what she says when she was having technical issues there, she says, sarcastically, there's nothing like technology.
Right.
And she wants to rely on technology to solve, quote-unquote, climate change.
Right. We can't even stop the feedback from a microphone.
Right.
But we're going to stop climate change.
And some level, she knows that technology isn't reliable.
Right.
Making that comment, you know, because we've all said it.
Yes, absolutely. Ain't technology awesome, except
yeah.
the 99% of the time when it doesn't work?
Yeah, and on that note.
Thank you, listeners. We're going to move on to the climate change update at this point. and it's pretty extensive. I only scratched the surface with an update last week, and I was already a week behind. I've got a lot of catching up to do, so please settle in for a long update on the climate change front, and Mike, feel free to interrupt with sarcastic comments at every turn. As usual, you can find all the following information within the Monster Essay on the blog. Research published in the December 17th, 2015 issue of Nature calculates spatial ice mass loss around the entire Greenland ice sheet from 1900 to present and finds, quote, that many areas currently undergoing change are identical to those that experienced considerable thinning throughout the 20th century, end quote. According to one of the paper's co-authors, quote, the average mass loss over the past decade is much larger than at any time over the last 115 years.
Wow. We can solve that.
Technology will fix it. I've added this information to feedback number 6. The December 17th, 2015 issue of Nature includes a paper describing shifts in the assembly of plants and animals. The bottom line of the abstract, quote, our results suggest that the rules governing the assembly of communities have recently been changed by human activity, end quote. What the authors fail to point out, of course, is that the human activity coincided with agriculture, that is, civilization. Attributing the damage to humans is an error, one that I hear all the time. Attributing the damage to civilized humans would be far more accurate. But civilization, like sex, death, and bodily functions, is absolutely taboo in the culture of make-believe.
Apparently agriculture is taboo as well.
Yes.
What are we supposed to do? Hunt and gather?
Right, exactly. You want us to go back living in caves and sucking the guts out of bugs? Is that what you want?
Is that what you want?
You can't even imagine. I'll quote from the abstract of a paper in the December 18th, 2015 issue of Science Advances, quote, many large tropical trees with sizable contributions to carbon stock rely on large vertebrates for seed dispersal and regeneration. However, many of these frugivores are threatened by hunting, illegal trade, and habitat loss. We found that defaunation has the potential to significantly erode carbon storage even when only a small proportion of large seeded trees are extirpated, end quote. In other words, because I have to provide an in other words because it's in the referee journal literature so nobody can understand what the fuck is going on there. Defaunation?
I just heard blah, 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 blah.
Right. Frugivores? Nobody knows what those mean. You know, I'm reminded of... This is just a year or two after I left active service at the university, and I'm at a conference. I'm helping select postdocs in a prestigious postdoctoral program, and there were three or four people on my panel and another three or four people on the other panel, and one of my panelists was the editor of Conservation Biology, the editor-in-chief of the premier journal in my field, and after spending 2.5 days with her, she said, you think quite a bit differently than other people I interact with. Mm. Yeah, that was shocking to me. She says, can you write an article that sort of explains your perspective on this whole civilization thing? Mm-hmm. And I said, sure. And I had it to her in about 24 hours. And then she edited it. And then the copy editor edited it. And by the time it was done, I couldn't read it. It was so filled with scientific jargon, it was completely unreadable by the average human being. It was quite a wake-up call for me that only 2 years later I didn't write in the accepted manner.
Right.
I wrote for people who understand English.
You wrote for the masses.
You know, and it reminds me of a line a colleague of mine came up with years ago. The three primary products of science are controversy, confusion, and publications.
So, I mean, in all seriously, do you think... I hate to use the word ploy because that just, but is there some thinking that maybe this is done so the average Joe, so to speak, can't relate, can't
absolutely
comprehend?
Absolutely. There's been quite a bit of work done on that topic.
Yeah.
Because that's what separates one science from another science, in part, is the jargon.
Right.
That's what keeps the silos intact.
Right.
So if you want to call yourself a conservation biologist, you have to use words like defaunation and frugivore. And the scientist in the next office, much less the next building, he doesn't even know what you're talking about.
Right. Right.
So therefore, you're somebody important.
Yeah.
Because you're using these words that, you know, nobody else uses.
And clearly that's restricted academics from really making connections with one another.
Absolutely. And from much less making connections with the populace at large.
And here we are.
What do you know? Anyway, to get back to that December 18th, 2015 issue of Science Advances in the paper there, the take-home message here is that climate change that causes the loss of habitat for animals, among other factors, of course, all of which are rooted in civilization, reduces the ability of tropical forests to store carbon, thus creating a self-reinforcing feedback loop. It's number 58 of the irreversible variety, bringing the total to 61. A paper in yesterday's issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that methane emissions during the Arctic cold season are higher than expected. Mm. The study found that far more methane is escaping from Arctic tundra during the cold months when the soil surface is frozen, that's generally from September through May, as well as from upland tundra than prevailing assumptions and climate modelers previously believed. In fact, researchers found that at least half of the annual methane emissions occur in the cold months, and that drier upland tundra can be a larger emitter of methane than wet tundra. This finding challenges critical assumptions in current global change models. I mean, you think about it, you would expect the methane to be released in the summertime when the permafrost is actively melting, when the methane is jumping up to the atmosphere, but more than half is coming in the cold 6 months. So nobody even looked at that before because it can't be emitting methane. It's wintertime.
We can't win.
It's not looking good.
No.
And that was not from yesterday, by the way. That was from December 20th, I believe. So it's been a while since that paper came out. I'm just catching up here. A paper published in the December 22nd, 2015 online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences reports, quote, that emissions during the cold season to September, that's September to May, contribute more than 50% of annual sources of methane from Alaskan tundra based on fluxes obtained from eddy covariance sites. There we go again with the language. And from regional fluxes calculated from aircraft data. I can hardly even read this myself. The dominance of late season emission sensitivity to soil conditions and importance of dry tundra are not currently simulated in most global climate models. In other words, methane bumbling out of the Arctic Ocean comes primarily during the winter months as well. It's not just the permafrost on land. It's also the stuff coming out of the Arctic Ocean. Everybody's been taking measurements only during the non-winter months in the Arctic Ocean, based on the assumption that methane would behave itself during the colder winter months. Seems the assumption is incorrect, with more than half, again, coming out during the winter months. Methane's been misbehaving. What a surprise. I've added this information feedback number one.
So they just apparently had some time in their hands to go, hey, we should just go out there during the winter once and see what's up.
Right.
Oh, shit.
We shouldn't have done that. Also, from the December 22nd, 2015 online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences comes a paper pointing out the link between Arctic sea ice and regional precipitation. I'll quote from the abstract of the paper.
Oh, please do.
I know you love it when I do that. Global climate is influenced by the Arctic hydrological cycle, which is in part regulated by sea ice through its control on evaporation and precipitation. We find that the independent direct effect of sea ice on the increase of the percentage of Arctic-sourced moisture likely result in increases of precipitation and changes in energy balance, creating significant uncertainty for climate predictions.
In other words,
I was hoping you'd lead that in for me. To quote the lead author of the paper, quote, if you remove sea ice from an Arctic area, you open up the ocean to the atmosphere and evaporate more water, which forms precipitation. So that precipitation, of course, melts the ice because it's water, not snow. Thus is born feedback number 62, which is number 59 of the irreversible variety. I thought I was done at 20 and at 30. Apparently I'm a slow learner. Paper in the December 22nd, 2015 issue of Global Change Biology reports that birds in the United States are already experiencing changes in habitat based on climate change. Here's the takeaway message from the abstract. Quote, we assessed how past climate change affected potential breeding distributions for land bird species in the conterminous United States. We quantified the pace and direction of change for each species' suitable climate space over the past 60 years. We found that potential breeding and distributions for land birds have shifted substantially with an average velocity about double the pace of prior distribution shift estimates across terrestrial systems globally, end quote. Faster than expected comes into play yet again. And if you believe changes in habitat for birds have no relevance for other animals on the planet, I have news for you. And it's not good news either. Contrary to the anthropomorphic perspective adopted by Christians and humanists, including Dr. Hayhoe, humans actually need other species if we are to persist on this tiny blue dot.
Say it isn't so.
You know, just yesterday, I came under vicious attack by this guy who says, no, you're wrong. You haven't taken into account people who are going to live in bunkers underground.
Right.
And then they're going to come out when things are all better.
Right.
And I pointed out that that would be several million years. And he really didn't want to hear that. I'm pretty sure he was afflicted with that syndrome we used to have, being a white male. Oh, we still have that.
And he was sitting in a bunker.
Right. A paper in the December 28th, 2015 online issue of the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences indicates Amazon forests could transition to savanna-like states in response to climate change. Savannas are simply described as grasslands with scattered trees or shrubs. The abstract of the paper suggests that, quote, in contrast to existing predictions of either stability or catastrophic biomass loss, the Amazon forest's response to a drying regional climate is likely to be an immediate, graded, heterogeneous transition from high biomass moist forests to transitional dry forests in woody savanna-like states. I've added this tidbit to feedback number 22. And, Mike, we're running short on time. We're going to catch up on the remaining articles in the climate change update next week. Why don't you take us on in?
All right. Well, that wraps it up this week. Make sure to like our Facebook page. It's Nature Bats Last and the Progressive Radio Network. And join our Facebook group as well. It's Nature Bats Last on PRN.FM. And feel free to post questions you'd like us to address in the show. Continue to follow Guy's blog at GuyMcPherson.com for further updates, essays, and speaking tours. We'll see you next week on the radio Tuesday afternoon at 3 p.m. Eastern. We'll be interviewing Hal. I can't pronounce his last name, but he wrote a great book that I'm almost finished with called Trees on Mars. And it'll be a fascinating show, let's just say that.
I think his last name is pronounced Nizvicky.
Nizvicky?
That's what I'm saying.
Okay, close enough. I'll listen to a YouTube clip and get it right.
Ooh, if you I should have thought of that.
You did. I just didn't listen to you. If you missed the show, make sure to find us in the archives at PRN.FM or at Stitcher and rate us on iTunes. All right. Well, until next time, remember, the dominant culture has been very clever, but in the end,
Nature Bats Last.
Mother Nature, Mother Nature, she's gonna get you.